Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. Welcome to your friendly neighborhood economist for December of 2012. This marks the end of the first year of this show, and I noticed that I only managed to pull together 8 shows this year. New Year's resolution, do better next year. Maybe 9. In today's show, I will, as usual, go over local, regional, national economic news. Then I'll discuss municipal finances. In other words, I'll explain how local governments get the money they use to operate and what they spend it on. Then I'll move on to introduce a little bit of the economic picture in Turkey, where I was for a couple of weeks last month, and in the process explain how international comparisons of economic well-being are made. Lots of exciting economics jargon to be broken down for you there. After that, I will address this fiscal cliff thingy all the talking heads on the TV seem to be excited about anymore. Should you be excited? Hoarding canned goods? Apathetic? Stay tuned and find out. Finally, a bit of facepalm on the radio as I discuss the different kinds of climate denial stalking the land and how we will all be taking another look at Waterworld and thinking that Kevin Costner is another Nostradamus, with gills in this case. Beware Krampus, because your friendly neighborhood economist is in. First, some economic news. Most of the local economics news over the past couple of months has been about town budgets, because most towns, cities, and counties in the regions have passed budget resolutions recently. You can see a listing of news items concerning them all in the show notes for this show. I'll be talking about municipal finances, as I said a little bit later, using Hudson as an example. There's been little change in the employment picture locally recently, with little change in the unemployment rate, so things are more or less stagnant along those lines. One exception to the lack of news about jobs is the fact that Premier Riverview LLC is moving into the Walmart building in Greenport, the empty one, not the full one. So that looks to bring about 25 jobs to the area, at least in the first year, and then they're thinking about 50 eventually. It's a warehousing operation for Premier Brands, which is health and beauty aid kind of products. And they're thinking about leasing out the front of the space to some kind of retail operation, although there doesn't seem to be any indication that they have anybody signed up for that. So we'll have to wait and see. But at least that part is going through, so there'll be a warehouse operation and some jobs for, some local folks coming up. So you can actually find a link to where to apply to those jobs in the story that's linked in the show notes. It was in the Register Star. In fracking news, which will come full circle when we talk about fracking, we're certainly going to be talking about the environment and climate change, since if we go on with fracking, we're going to be burning a lot more carbon this century than is compatible with the current climate. And the current climate, of course, is the climate that our entire civilization is based upon. So maybe you should care about that. But anyway, in local news, Taconic, the town of Taconic, passes a fracking moratorium. The Register Star reported on that. That's exciting. In Hudson, at a local temple, they had a couple of speakers talking about fracking. First, Karen Moreau, who's the executive director of the New York State Petroleum Council, which is a division of the American Petroleum Institute, the industry group for the petroleum industry, oil and gas. Not surprisingly, she was very positive and upbeat about the economic benefits that fracking would bring to New York, especially the southern tier. And you can read all about that in the story that's linked in the show notes. Anthony LaSalvia, however, the next week offered some opposing opinions about the supposed economic benefits of fracking, listing a number of, some of the downsides to fracking, which we've covered before on the show. So, you know, you can weigh those as you will. And like I said, it's all linked in the show notes. At the state level, the health department's input is going to delay release of fracking regulatory guidelines because they want the Department of Environmental Conservation wants the health department to comment on the health impact part of their report. So that's going to take a little longer than the original guideline timeline. Meanwhile, the state is taking comments on proposed fracking rules from the public. So if you're interested, you should check that out and weigh in. This might be the last time you get a chance to do that in a meaningful way, unfortunately. As I said, a lot of local towns and cities and counties have recently passed budget resolutions, and I have links to all those stories about them anyway in my notes. Hudson, there were more stories than usual. The budget proposal is one thing that I found for you, and I'll be discussing that in a little more detail. You know, you might have heard already a couple things about this. One of the things is that the parking rate is slated to go up to 50 cents an hour for meters in Hudson, which still seems pretty cheap to me. And there's been some discussion of the health insurance buyouts for aldermen and police overtime versus hiring some part-timers, which apparently is an oldie but a goodie in budget talks concerning the police budget in Hudson, which doesn't seem to have been resolved yet one way or the other. The Common Council president is going to get a raise, 115%, from $5,800 to $12,500 a year. And that all the proposals have been adopted by the Common Council. So the 2013 budget that I'm going to be talking about, the proposal has been accepted. Also, in addition to all the different towns, Ichapod Crane School District approved their budget. Columbia County and Greene County both approved their budgets. So those are some interesting reading. You should check them out. But there's just too many of them to go over all of them. So I'm going to stick to one in a bit. All right, hang on to your hats. We're going to talk about municipal finances. This one goes out to Noah, who requested last summer now, already months ago, that I do a bit about municipal finances on the show. So here goes. To do this, I took a closer look at the proposed and now approved Hudson City budget to get a better idea of how the city of Hudson operates in terms of where the money to provide the services comes from and where it goes. So first of all, let's talk about the sources of financing for the city, so where the money comes from. The proposed 2013 budget is just under $12 million. That's about $1,800 per resident. You can break the sources of that money up into three big chunks. The first, smallest chunk, consists of self-financed departments. That's water, sewer, and cemetery. Together, these three account for about $2.4 million. And as I say, they're self-financed because the fees that property owners pay for water and sewer fully fund their respective city departments. Whether they're adequately funded by those fees is another question, of course. But what they bring in is enough to cover their expenses. The same is also true for the cemetery. It's also paid for by user fees, so to speak. So those fees all together, so that $2.4 million for those three departments, accounts for about 20% of the budget. And they go directly for the appropriate services, as I said. The other two big chunks of money go to the general fund, out of which everything else the city does gets paid for. The slightly larger part of this is property taxes, which are projected to be about $4.7 million for next year, a little over 39% of all the money coming into city government. General revenues is the next largest chunk at 39%, and And it's projected to be a little under 4.7 million. And it consists of about 50 different items, everything from marriage license fees to hunting licenses to bingo proceeds. The two biggest parts of this category are state revenue sharing and county sales tax contributions. These are transfers from the state and county treasuries, respectively. So the state is projected to give the city about $1.5 million during the 2013 fiscal year, or about 12% of the city's budget. This money comes from state revenues, mostly income taxes, but also sales taxes and other kinds of taxes as well. Some of the money the state brings in, it spends directly, but a lot goes to cities and towns, as well as school districts and other government units. The county government also brings in revenue from sales taxes, most of its revenue. And what it doesn't spend on county services like snowplows and the sheriff's office, it distributes to towns. For the next fiscal year, that's projected to be about $1.3 million, or just under 11% of the city budget. So almost one out of every $4 the city spends comes from the state or the county. Two other items that are of interest to anyone who parks in downtown are the revenues from parking meters, permits, and the municipal lots, and from parking tickets. The proposed parking rates are double what they are now, so they're going up to 50 cents an hour. Like I said, that still sounds cheap to someone like me who used to live in Boston, and certainly anybody who lived in New York City. So the revenue from parking is projected to be $265,000, while the revenue from parking tickets is projected to be about $200,000. Together, they're less than 5% of the budget, but I thought it was an interestingly similar amount between those two, almost half of the money from parking coming from parking tickets. So good money there. In terms of spending, the single biggest item is the police department at just under $2.7 million. This doesn't include employee benefits, which have their own separate account in the overall budget and are not itemized by department. Now, that $2.7 million for the police department is about 23% of the budget, so almost one out of every $4 goes to the police. The water department is the next largest item at $1.2 million, or 10%, then sewers at $1 million. 8%, and streets at $880,000, 7%. And again, remember, water and sewer come from fees that they charge to users directly, so homeowners and property owners in the city. Another huge chunk of the budget is employee benefits, which includes health insurance, which is just under $1.5 million, or 12% of the budget. Then there's state retirement, which is $885,000, or 7%. And Social Security at about $328,000, or 3%. Add up all the benefits and you get over $2.8 million, or 24%. So it's another good reason that we should really be seriously thinking about fixing healthcare, because the healthcare problem isn't a Medicare problem. It's not a health insurance problem. It's a cost problem. And, you know, insurance companies might be a part of that, but they're not the whole thing. So you might be wondering, though, what about schools? I didn't mention those at all. That's usually a pretty big ticket item. In Hudson, as in many other communities around New York State and the country, the school district is a distinct governmental entity and has its own separate governance structure and funding. In Hudson's case, the school district includes not just the city of Hudson, but also parts of surrounding towns. For example, I pay Hudson School District taxes, although I live in Livingston. And so the money for the Hudson School District comes from all the people in the school district. So everybody in the school district who pays property taxes, all the homeowners and business owners, they pay a separate amount that goes to the school district, not to the city or the town that they live in. So I pay property taxes to the town of Livingston, which pays for my town's services, but the school district taxes I pay go to Hudson. So there you go. Now, Hudson is one example of how municipal finances work. Each and every town and city does it differently. The relationships between county and state and city are different in different states. The relationship between school districts and municipalities are different in different cities and counties and states. For example, New York City is one big school district. which, you know, seems pretty overwhelming because it's a lot of people. Whereas, you know, in Hudson, we have one school district that encompasses Hudson and a number of the outlying communities. So, you know, there's no single way that municipal finances work. But in general, the revenue for cities and towns comes from property taxes mostly, right? And we saw that that's almost half of the budget for, it's 40% of the budget for Hudson, and that's a similar number for other places. But it also comes from the state and the county in the case of New York. For example, county governments are much more important than, say, Massachusetts, where they're not quite as important. They don't have as much power. They don't have as much revenue. Okay, now I'd like to tell you a little bit about Turkey, economic conditions there. And that's going to branch into a discussion about exchange rates and purchasing power parity. I bet that sounds exciting. So first, about the economic conditions in Turkey. Turkey's had fairly fast growth over the last decade, but there's been no change really in the high levels of inequality that it suffers. Unemployment is still high. It's about 8%. And that is given the fact that women in Turkey have a very low labor force participation rate. That means, you know, at what rate do, you know, working age women attempt to participate in the labor force, either get a job or look for a job. It's about 25%. So one in four Turkish working age women are either employed or looking for work. So that's pretty small compared to, say, the U.S., which is more like 70%. For Turkey, most of the tax revenue that funds the federal government is gotten through a sales tax of 18%, which is levied on most goods, while the income tax is almost universally avoided. The funny thing about Turkey is that most everybody claims that they make the minimum wage on their taxes, including players on big soccer teams in the National League like Fenerbahce, Galatasaray, or Beşiktaş. This means that the poorest workers in Turkey face the heaviest tax burden since they actually make the minimum wage. And so they have to also pay the sales tax on most things they buy from that meager wage. The minimum, by the way, is not very large, just a couple hundred bucks a month. So given all that, workers are in a bad state, especially since they've still not regained the real right to organize unions since the military coup in the 1980s, which did away with a lot of labor rights that workers in Turkey had before then. Turkey is no longer ruled by a military coup. They now have a democratically elected government, but that government has yet to restore those labor rights. So workers are in a bad position partly as a result of that as well. Turkey suffers from fairly high inflation, which is about 8% a year right now. It can help or hurt you. I mean, we've talked about this before. You know, who does inflation hurt the most? It's people who are owed money. So bankers are the people who are hurt the most, as long as workers' pay keeps pace with inflation. They don't tend to be the ones who are hurt by inflation. But whether or not that's true of Turkey is, you know, remains to be seen. So just comparing overall standard of living, a typical measure of economic well-being or the standard of living is the GDP per capita. We've talked about this before when we were much younger, maybe in January. GDP is gross domestic product, which is basically just a measure of all the goods and services that are produced in a country in a year. And to get the per capita, you divide that by the population, right? So per capita means per person. So in U.S. dollars at the current exchange rate, Turkey's per capita gross domestic product in 2011 was $10,498, compared to the U.S., which in 2011 was $48,328 per person. So it's about 22%. Interestingly, though, if you use a slightly different measure, which is called purchasing power parity, and I'll explain what that means exactly in a bit, the comparison is a little different, because then Turks, the average Turkish person, has $17,499 compared to the U.S. U.S. doesn't change because it's whatever everything is compared to. Purchasing power parity is usually in U.S. dollars. So then the average Turkish person has about 36% of the income of the average U.S. person, or the average share of the goods and services produced in the country and the income produced in the country. So let's talk a little bit about exchange rates, purchasing power parity, and the Big Mac Index. So now I have your attention, right? Big Macs. Well, exchange rate. The exchange rate is the price of a foreign currency, like the Canadian dollar, the Mexican peso, or the Turkish lira, in terms of your own country's currency. So it's the price, basically, of another country's currency. How many dollars do you have to pay, or how many lira, Turkish lira, do you need to buy a dollar? Right? That's the exchange rate I'll be talking about right now. So if you go to some other country, you mostly can't use dollars, though there are exceptions, like Ecuador, which uses the U.S. dollar as its currency. So in most places, though, you'll need to buy some of the local currency with your dollars. The nominal value of GDP per capita was based on the exchange rate between the Turkish lira and the U.S. dollar. So that amount times the exchange rate gives you the Turkish GDP per capita in Turkish lira. Of course, it's hard to use different currencies in comparisons, so we convert. That way we can compare dollars to dollars rather than lira to dollars, right? The lira to dollars comparison loses something in its explanatory power. Now, the trick is, though, that there are differences in prices in different countries for similar goods and services. So we want some way to adjust the exchange rate to take those differences into account. This is the same general idea as trying to compare, you know, the average income in the U.S. today to some time in the past. You know, the thing is, things have gotten more expensive since, you know, 1970 or 1940 or whenever you want to compare to. So we have to adjust, right, for inflation. We adjust for differences in prices. Otherwise, we think, you know, we would end up thinking we're much, much more well off than we really are in comparison to people in 1940 or 1970 or whenever we're trying to compare to. So this is where purchasing power parity comes in. And so inflation is a way to measure how purchasing power of a currency, you know, for example, the dollar changes over time, right? So the dollar that you have in your pocket today looks the same, feels the same, smells the same, but you can't buy as much with it because prices have gone up, right? You know, you can certainly think of things that have gone up in price. You know, food has gone up a lot in the last couple of years. Certainly gas has gone up quite a bit as well. So, you know, you can't buy as much gas, you can't buy as much food with a dollar today as you could have a couple years ago. So your purchasing power, right, has declined. If your income has stayed the same, your purchasing power has declined. So if your income keeps pace, then your purchasing power stays the same, even though the dollar value is bigger. Okay, so The Economist magazine has an interesting way to illustrate this concept. It's oversimplified, but it's fun. They use something called the Big Mac Index. You may have heard of a Big Mac. It's a burger sold by a little chain called McDonald's. And as you may know, wherever you go in the world, you won't be far from a McDonald's, at least in big cities. They all sell Big Macs, so we can use that to compare the exchange rate with the difference in purchasing power. Okay, so in Turkey, Big Mac prices in the local currency, the Turkish lira, are 8.25. So eight and a quarter liras will get you a Big Mac on average in Turkey, in Istanbul or Ankara. Now, at the market exchange rate, that works out to $4.52. Now, the U.S. Price on average of a Big Mac is $4.33. So if you take the price in Turkish liras, 825 lira, and divide by the price in of Big Macs in the U.S., $4.33, you get a figure of 1.91 lira per dollar. So that's the implied purchasing power of the dollar in terms of Turkish lira, right? So a dollar has 1.91 times the purchasing power of a Turkish lira, at least in terms of Big Macs, right? So you can buy 1.91 times as many Big Macs with a dollar as you can with a lira, okay? Now, if you compare that to the actual dollar exchange rate in July of 2012, which is when all these numbers are from, that was 1 Turkish lira 0.83 per dollar, okay? So according to the Big Macs index, the Big Mac index, the lira is actually overvalued against the dollar by 4%. In other words, the exchange rate should be higher, more liras per dollar, 191, right? So, of course, you might remember, although this was ages ago now, at least, I'm sure it's seemed like ages, the actual difference between purchasing power parity and nominal exchange rates is much larger. One of the reasons for that, of course, is that Big Macs are not a big part of Turkish people's diets, luckily for them, not as big as they are in the U.S. anyway. So purchasing power parity is actually based on a much larger selection of goods and services than just, you know, one sandwich. You know, the goods and services that people need for their daily life. So things like heating, shelter, right, housing, that kind of thing, clothes, food, you know, food that they normally eat rather than, you know, Big Macs. So the fact that Turkey's purchasing power parity per capita GDP, and if you want to be really fancy, you can say PPP GDP per capita, which is really fun to say, is larger than the nominal, means that things are generally cheaper in Turkey, so your dollars can get you more food in Turkey than the U.S., right? So remember that in purchasing power parity terms, Turkish people were making $17,000 compared to $10,000 in just flat exchange rate terms. So the dollar goes further in Turkey than the exchange rate would lead you to believe. And this is because exchange rates aren't only determined by relative prices in the two countries, right? So there are other things that enter into the exchange rate. And some of those things are trade between the U.S. and Turkey, right? So when we import goods and services from Turkey, we pay for it in lira, so we have to buy lira, and vice versa, right? When Turkish companies want to import goods and services from the U.S., like Apples and iMacs and all that kind of stuff, iPads, you know, whatever Apple makes, they have to pay in dollars, right? Because American companies want to be paid in dollars. So those trade flows affect the exchange rate. So whichever way there are more goods and services flowing means that way the currency is relatively stronger because there's a larger demand for it. There's also a lot of speculation that goes on. If you're somebody like Warren Buffett, you have a ton of cash sitting around. You're wondering how best to make money on it. So one thing you can do is look at different currencies, say the Turkish lira, and think to yourself, well, what do I think is going to happen to the lira? And if you think that lira are going to appreciate in value relative to the dollar so that in the future you'll be able to buy more dollars with a lira than now, you might want to buy lira, hold on to them, and then sell them in the future when your predictions come true. Of course, it's speculation, right? Because you don't know. A lot of those kinds of speculative transactions are actually super short term. You might only hold that money for, you know, a couple seconds and wait for tiny little changes in the exchange rate, you know, is in your favor, and you can still make a ton of money if you're starting off with a ton of money. So this is nothing you and I are ever going to do, probably, but that's how it works. So those are the general reasons why, you know, the exchange rate might be different than the differences in prices in the two countries would otherwise indicate. So one other thing about the GDP per capita, right, is their averages. So this is moving back to actually comparing well-being between the two countries again. So per capita GDP means the total value of the goods and services produced in the country in a year divided by the population. That doesn't really tell you how it's distributed. It's just an average, right? So how does Turkey compare to the U.S. in terms of inequality? Common measure of inequality is called the Gini coefficient. I don't know if I've mentioned that one before, but it's very common. And it basically measures how far an economy is from a perfectly equal distribution of income. The closer to zero you are in the Gini means you are more equally distributed. A Gini of zero means that everybody has exactly the same amount of income. The closer to 100 you are, the less equally distributed income is. So if you had actually 100 for Gini, that means that one person gets all the income, right? And everybody else gets zero. So obviously, all countries are somewhere in between, and the U.S. and Turkey are no different. The Gini for the U.S. is 47, while the Gini for Turkey is 40. So we actually have more unequal distribution of income in the U.S. than in Turkey. So next time, I hope I'll have a little bit more about Turkey. I know you're hoping that as well. Hopefully including some thoughts from my friend Yahya, a Turkish economist, on the overall trends in the Turkish economy over the last few decades. So I hope you'll be looking forward to that. I know I will. So now we're going to turn to all this fiscal cliff stuff that's been floating around in the air, especially in Washington and perhaps polluting the airwaves in your vicinity. So first thing I want to do is play a clip from the Real News Network, which did an interview with James K. Galbraith, son of John Kenneth Galbraith, professor at University of Texas at Austin. And he explains exactly why the fiscal cliff is a scam. It's a multi-part interview and a video, and you should definitely check out the whole thing. I'm going to give you the introduction because that kind of gives you a nice overview of the argument, which should be enough to get you pretty riled up, shall we say. Okay, so here's Jamie Galbraith.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. The fiscal cliff is a scam, so says Professor James K. Galbraith, and he's written an article which goes through the six reasons he thinks it is such a scam, and we're going to start as we speak a six-part series where we go through each of his reasons, and he now joins us. Professor James K. Galbraith teaches at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Predator State. And the latest among his many publications is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. Thanks for joining us, James.
My pleasure, as always.
So just before we start with reason number one, just give us sort of the overall headline why you think the fiscal cliff is a scam. Certainly the media is stampeding us with fear about what's going to happen.
Well, what I wrote was that it is a crisis that was contrived a year ago as a deal, part of the deal to permit lifting of the debt ceiling. And these deadlines, which were set up for the end of this year, were established so as to create a climate of crisis in the period after the election, when things could be done that would no longer be immediately subject to the kind of public debate that you get before the election. And so we're now in this period. It was clear from election day that a massive wave of public relations was being brought to bear on this. You could read the op-eds that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times on election day on that point. And now we're in the middle of it. And the claim being made is that if there isn't a decision taken by the end of this year, which effectively means really in the next 3 weeks or so, that very bad things will happen to the economy. And of course, it isn't true. The reality is that while there will be changes that in tax rates, for example, that will take effect on January 1st, the impact of those changes on economic activity will be very slow, very gradual. And the Congress coming in January will have plenty of opportunity to mitigate, eliminate those effects if it chooses to do that. And it can set the whole business back retroactively to the first of the year. So if there isn't if the crisis, so-called crisis, simply passes with no legislative action this year, nothing very serious will happen that can't be fixed in the first 6 weeks or so of next year.
Now, you've written that the computer modeling that is being presented to us isn't correct. We're being told that this is tremendously recessionary and or doesn't deal properly with the debt. And we saw an interview with the head of Goldman Sachs on 60 Minutes who says the fact that all this has, the economy has such a question mark over it, is paralyzing investment. You don't buy this.
The notion that this is being, that the condition of the economy has been driven by uncertainty that can somehow be resolved by an act of Congress in the next 3 weeks is, of course, the last refuge of a very first-class scoundrel. What's true here is that if you allowed major increases in tax rates on the middle class and on working people, because the payroll tax holiday will expire at the beginning of the year, if you allow all of that to continue to bite for 6 months or a year, then it would begin to squeeze people's consumption, and you would have a significant effect on total demand by the end of the year. And that's what the Congressional Budget Office said, and I think that's a fair point. But there is absolutely no reason to believe that you need to act by December 21st in order to avoid that effect. If you acted by January 31st or February 15th, you would mitigate that effect in plenty of time.
So the point you're making is this doesn't have to be done in the midst of crisis and hysterical mentality.
Right. And there is a reason, there are two reasons why the pressure is on to do it in an atmosphere of crisis. Reason number one is that the Congress will be significantly more Democratic next year than it is this year. The Senate will have two extra Democratic votes, and the composition of that majority will be significantly different, substantially more progressive in important ways. Secondly, there is clearly a desire to put into law now in this Congress long-term changes in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That was the agenda of the people who designed the fiscal cliff. They said, well, we'll set up a crisis, and at the end of 2012, we'll come in with these changes. And that might be, for example, curtailing the cost of living adjustments in Social Security, raising the age of eligibility for Medicare, any number of things which in effect would cut benefits, or in the case of what I just said about Medicare, basically a partial privatization, forcing right. people to rely on private insurance for a couple of extra years. So that's what was being held in reserve for the post-election period, and that the danger remains is that at the end of this Congress, we'll have in the last few days some concession on the Republican side on the tax issues, and the Democratic leadership will come in and say, specifically the White House will come in and say, well, now we've got what we want on taxes. We need to make a concession on Medicare, Medicaid. I think Social Security has been taken off the table for the moment. We may have won that battle, but I'm still concerned that what may happen to our very important health insurance programs, totally unnecessarily, will be kind of folded in as a kind of necessary right. concession at the end of this set.
Well, we're going to talk more about this part in part two of this series of interviews. But in the article you wrote, you talk about the CBO revising its own forecasts. And what was that about?
Well, that has to do with these longer term deficit forecasts, which have been part of the climate of preoccupation with the deficit, the national debt, all along. And one of the ironies of the situation we're in now is that the fiscal cliff is actually a reduction in deficits. And the same people who were telling us that we need to be frightened about the long-term deficit are telling us that we need to be frightened about too small a short-term deficit. And you can easily understand why for the larger public this is just a tiny bit confusing. But those long-term CBO forecasts of very rapidly rising national debt, very rapidly rising deficits, rest on a couple of very doubtful assumptions. One is that healthcare costs will continue to rise more rapidly than every other cost in the economy forever. Can't happen, won't happen. But that's, you can build a computer forecast that makes it happen, in which it happens. And the other is that the interest rate that the federal government pays on its public debt will be raised by the Federal Reserve, let's say 4 years from now, to a point where it's higher than the growth rate of total output, the growth rate of income. And then that interest burden compounds, the interest payments compound as a share of GDP and go up very rapidly after that. If you stretch out that forecast long enough, you can get a debt to GDP ratio as high as you like in a computer projection. But once again, it will not happen in real life. It's not it's not consistent with the way an actual economy is going to function.
So again, an artificial sense of urgency being created.
An artificial sense of urgency about events that are 30 or 40 years off. It's a very strange situation. And we have obvious pressing problems, unemployment, foreclosures, energy, climate change. We have clear things that should be at the top of our priorities. And instead, you have this preoccupation, this obsessive preoccupation with computer projections, which are easily, let's say, easily rebutted, and which in any event, are making statements about events that are highly conjectural and very far in the future.
So there you have an interesting explanation of why the fiscal cliff is a scam. And unfortunately, I think both parties are in on the scam, including the president we just reelected. Unfortunately, I think he really believes that we need to cut entitlements, as the rhetoric is in Washington these days. They call things like Social Security and Medicare, they call them entitlements, although these are things that people paid into their whole life. So I'm not sure why it gets this negative connotation. When you've paid into something your whole life, you do expect something back, because that was the promise, right? So these are benefits that you've already paid for by participating in the program your whole working life, not entitlements. Just one little point there, I think an important one. So the Democrats are just itching to give away Social Security and Medicare, it seems to me. Not all of them, but it seems like many of them, unfortunately. The Republicans, for their part, are still pitching the Romney plan. For example, Chris Gibson, there's a story on the GXC archives. Although he's backed off from the Grover Norquist no tax pledge, he's still pushing the party line, which is that there are going to be no tax rate increases. Just we're going to fiddle with some loopholes and deductions. Right, as though that is going to fix the gap in the budget, if you think that's important to fix to begin with. But, you know, it certainly isn't going to fix the deficit. What is going to fix the deficit eventually is going to be economic growth. As long as we get the economy growing again, it's going to increase revenue, because the more people make, the more they pay in taxes, right? More income means more tax revenue. It also means less spending, because if people are employed, they're not getting unemployment benefits, they're not on Medicaid, they're not getting food stamps, right? If they're actually able to provide for themselves, the government programs that are set up to provide for people who can't provide for themselves won't have to pitch in. And so it's going to have a balancing effect on the budget. Of course, it won't be enough to offset the huge unfunded spending that we're doing on the war in Afghanistan, for example, or on the Medicare prescription drug program that was put in without any kind of way to pay for it, and designed to be super expensive. and giveaway to the pharmaceutical industry. Of course, you know, we could fix that. That would be a good way to go about fighting the deficit if you're really serious about it. But that's not what we're talking about, unfortunately. So we have what we have. So we'll see what comes out of it. The best case, they'll do nothing before the end of the year. The alleged doomsday will happen, and you know there won't be a great big hole that will swallow up the United States economy. Things will just slowly start to decline, and at that point, right? At that point, you know, if the president and the Democratic Party were serious about the things they talk about, you know, preserving the social safety net, for example, you know, that would be a good place to be in a bargaining position with Republicans, saying, "Okay, we're here. We have the fiscal cliff. The catastrophe is happening, right? Taxes have gone back up, so let's have tax cuts for people making less than $250,000, right? They could do that then, and let the Republicans vote against tax cuts, right? That would be interesting. Perfect, easy to do, but don't hold your breath. I won't be." Finally, let's talk about climate denial today. A lot of people are in denial. There are a couple different varieties of denial going around. There's the James Inhofe, you know, climate change denier camp that deny that it's actually happening, despite the overwhelming scientific consensus and the overwhelming amounts of evidence around us that things are changing as, you know, the theory, the climate science theory would predict if the world was warming up. But, you know, evidence doesn't seem to count much with some people. But, you know, there aren't all that many people in that kind of climate denial, which is good, although it's disturbing how many people in positions of power are in that strange state. There are a lot more people who are in climate denial of another kind. This kind of climate denial is basically denial about the urgency and the scale of the problem. This past month, the climate talks are held in Doha, in Qatar, which is, you know, kind of an ironic place to hold talks about the climate, being a big oil-producing nation that it is. These talks were disappointing for a lot of people, including myself. Others weren't very disappointed because they had kind of low expectations. You know, the idea was that these talks and the talks next year are really meant just to be a prelude to the serious talks that we're going to have in 2015, when we're going to reach a deal and then we're finally going to do something, maybe. Meanwhile, as the Doha talks are starting, new reports are coming out. One warns that melting permafrost, which so far has not been taken into account in climate change predictions. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which has come out with several iterations of reports about the state of climate science, the predictions, you know, what are the range of possibilities for global warming and over the next century or so. None of those predictions have taken into account the effect of melting permafrost because there hasn't been data available. And there still isn't a lot of data available, but this new report suggests that melting permafrost will add significantly to warming because the permafrost, so these are, if you don't know, permafrost is ground that's frozen year-round, pretty much. So it's in the Arctic Circle, mostly in the U.S. In Canada, the U.S., Russia, you know, the Arctic nations. And there are a lot of greenhouse gases, methane and carbon dioxide, trapped in the frozen ground. When that frozen ground melts, in addition to the environmental impacts it'll have on, you know, the the ecosystems in those areas, you know, the that have, you know, evolved in a state of living around permafrost, right? You know, those environmental impacts aside, they'll release greenhouse gases and increase the rate of global warming. So, you know, that's one report that comes out the same week as the Doha meetings begin. Another is put out by that rabid tree-hugging institution, the World Bank, and it says that we should be preparing for more than 4 degrees Celsius warming, right? 4 degrees is kind of the upper limit of what they say we should be shooting for. You know, that even is, they're saying too much, right? But they're saying that we should be preparing for even greater warming because the all of the predictions that scientists have been making based on climate science about the Earth warming, you know, in terms of glaciers melting, in terms of the Arctic ice cap melting, in terms of ocean temperatures, in terms of air temperatures, in terms of humidity in the air, right? By the way, a warmer planet, more water in the air, more water vapor, which is also a greenhouse gas. Woohoo! All these predictions have been famously proving to be very conservative. And so the sea ice in the Arctic is melting at a greater rate than predicted. Glaciers are melting at a greater rate than predicted. Oceans are warming at a greater rate than predicted. Oceans are getting acidic at a greater rate than predicted. You know, right down the line, all the predictions are true. They just weren't big enough. So, you know, you might think that that might be a cause for concern, that, you know, it might spur some action. You might think that. You might be disappointed as well. So while all this is happening, of course, you may have heard about this storm Sandy. This happens to have happened while I was in Turkey, so I missed Hurricane Sandy by about a day. Governor Cuomo came out and said that Sandy is going to be worse than Katrina in terms of the dollars, right? The cost of cleaning up and repairing New York City after the storm. This is an important point because although generally you can't link individual weather events, storms, etc., to global warming, this one you definitely can, because you had 5 degree warmer than usual Atlantic Ocean, higher seas than usual, warmer air than usual. All these three things combined to give you a much more powerful storm than you would have had in November in the Northeast. You know, if this year had been, in terms of the climate, like an average 20th century year, Sandy would never have been the kind of storm that it was. You would never have seen the storm surges that you saw that wiped out coastlines along New Jersey, Long Island, Staten Island, New York City, and Brooklyn. So, you know, Sandy is a storm that you can link to global warming, right? Because the warmer climate directly contributed to the strength of the storm and its impact on land. Now, these sorts of storms of the century, storms coming every year or so, is going to be more and more the new normal, as I've been calling it. This means that more and more of our dollars will be spent cleaning up and repairing the damage from these storms. Instead of improving our crumbling infrastructure, we'll be struggling to keep up. Never mind, you know, improving our infrastructure. This is going to divert investment from technological progress, which could otherwise help us avert the coming disasters. In short, you know, the time to act is now, not 2 years from now, not 10 years from now. You know, the climate, the global climate is like an ocean liner, you know, that we're all on. And right now it's steaming towards the shore. And if we want to avoid hitting the reefs and sinking, we have to start turning the ship, right? And soon, because this ship is not going to turn quickly, right? The climate has a huge amount of momentum in these changes that we've affected in it. And unless we start to change it, change the effect we're having on it, and reduce the impact that we're having on it, you know, it's just going to be a very different planet that we leave our children, our grandchildren. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, just widespread catastrophic starvation, disease, famine. You know, these are doomsday scenarios, but these are the kinds of scenarios that are quite likely if we go above four degrees Celsius. You know, it's just going to be a vastly different climate than we have evolved in, that we have evolved our civilization and our food system in. So it's not something we should be taking lightly, and unfortunately, that's what our leaders seem to be doing. You know, I think it was Noam Chomsky who described the what little mention of the climate in the presidential campaign this year basically amounted to how fast the lemmings should be running towards the cliff, and we still seem to be running towards the cliff.
If you want something you can actually do about it, check out gofossilfree.org. That's all one word, gofossilfree, for a campaign to urge institutional investors like university endowments to divest themselves from ownership of fossil fuel industry corporations. This campaign takes a page out of the successful effort to put pressure on the apartheid regime in South Africa in the 1980s, which helped to end that regime. So hopefully we can leverage the same kind of ideas and strategies to do something about the fossil fuel industry. If you go check out that website, you'll find out that the fossil fuel industry currently has, you know, as part of their stock valuation, the reserves that they have is five times what we can afford to burn and still remain under 2 degrees Celsius temperature rise over the next 100 years. So five times as much. Clearly their business model is not good for the planet or for us. So go ahead and check out that website and get involved.
This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the third Wednesday of every month or anytime online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook at Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist, on Twitter at YFNEconomist, or on Tumblr at YFNEconomist.tumblr.com. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, send it to me through one of those venues or email me at YFNEconomist@gmail.com. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is brought to you by WGXC 90.7 FM Hudson Catskill ACRA and produced by Thomas Masterson. That's me. I'll talk to you next month.